Yeah.
God bless you. Okay. Bye.
Bye bye. You know, I'm happy that we end on a note of conciliation, cooperation, compassion. And I want to once again bring attention to what we did at the top of the show. Let us have those same emotions and commitments to all of those who have died in this venture, because human life is the most sacred thing we've got here. And we have to, if we can't treat people right, we certainly can't treat anything else right. Hope, though, you will treat KBOO right. Don't forget, we're in the middle of our drive. Stop by our website, kboo.fm, and support us. Thank you for your calls and for listening. Thanks to Ray, our engineer. Stay tuned to the Old Mo Variety Hour.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
Listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual fall membership drive. You can help us meet our $55,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $14,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give.
KBOO.
Nations and our people that have been living here for thousands of years.
Stand up.
We've been fighting for our freedom since the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
Stand up.
Like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Lenin Peltier.
Stand up.
Now they poison in the waters for our sons and our daughters, so we on the frontier.
We
one nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline.
Good morning. That was a mashup of the Old Mole song and Taboo singing Stand Up for Standing Rock. This is KBOO Portland, your listener-supported radio station. And this is Lakota Cheyenne Mole Robin White coming to you from Ariel, Washington. I'll be your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour, a show that brings you news and views from a socialist, feminist, decolonizing perspective.
And I'm Patricia Kohlberg, here to remind you this morning that today's Indigenous Peoples Day special is brought to you by generous donors like you. 80% of our operating funds comes from our listeners, and right now, a generous group of KBOO donors has offered to match your donation, dollar for dollar, up to $14,000. Donate today and double your contribution. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by clicking on the donate button on your KBOO app. Now back to Robin.
For today's Indigenous Peoples Day show, we'll be playing music from an all-Native lineup of artists, and we'll hear the following segments. Judy Blue Horse Skelton, Nez Perce Cherokee, Assistant Professor at Portland State University, PSU, and Emma Johnson, Cowlitz, Senior Instructor at Portland State University, both in the Indigenous Nations Studies Department, discussed their collaborative work in Indigenous Traditional Ecological and Cultural Knowledge, ITEC, which provides a counterpoint to the Western worldview, which places human separate from Mother Earth. They discuss PSU's new ITEC certificate, a place-based and community-based curriculum that centers our plant-based relatives, decolonizes academia, supports tribal food sovereignty, and offers people a chance to better connect with the landscape they call home. Following that segment, we'll have excerpts from a plenary panel from Washington State University's April 2023 SJCon conference, exploring the intersections of Native sovereignty, decolonization, divestment, reparations, and environmental justice, constructing coalitions at the intersections. Facilitated by Robin White, the panel features Robert Cullen, retired law professor, writer, and environmental justice activist, Rachel Cushman, Chinook, member of the Chinook Indian Nation Council, Kent Ford, co-founder, Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party, and Kathy Sampson Cruz, Wallulapam Band, Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. The final segment of today's show is a reading from C. Marie Furman, an author and poet whose work is rooted in the landscape of the West and includes a collection of poems, Camped Beneath the Dam, and two anthologies, Cascadia Field Guide, Art, Ecology, and Poetry, and Native Voices, Indigenous Poetry, Craft, and Conversations. She has published or has forthcoming poetry and nonfiction in multiple journals, including Terrain.org, Emergence Magazine, Platform Review, Northwest Review, Yellow Medicine Review, Poetry Northwest, and several anthologies. C. Marie is a regular columnist for the Islander Transitions Editor and for Broadsided Press. And the Elk River Writers Workshop Director, C. Marie is the Associate Director of the Graduate Program in Creative Writing at Western Colorado University, where she also directs the poetry program and teaches nature writing. She is the current Idaho writer in residence and resides in the mountains of West Central Idaho. And here's Judy Blue Horse Skelton and Emma Johnson speaking about the Indigenous Traditional Ecological and Cultural Knowledge, ITEC.
Tatsmi wi, everyone. It's good to be here. Welcome. It's really an honor to be invited to share what we've been up to in Indigenous Traditional Ecological and Cultural Knowledge with our students and community and partners in the region. And so we're really looking forward in our always too brief time to share a little bit about what's going on and our ITEC certificate and what Indigenous folks have been doing to reclaim our health, heal the land, heal the people. So thank you for being here. So we're really excited to be presenting on the role of Indigenous Traditional Ecological and Cultural Knowledge in decolonizing academia and nurturing our healthy futures through our first foods and plant relatives. And this is a fresh photo of our Indigenous leaders for sustainable futures and our tribal internship class, and also our First Foods and the Pacific Northwest class. We were out at the Bureau of Environmental Services partnership site in Shokake Wetlands. And that's about a 5-acre site in the Columbia Slough in the Portland metro region. And we are in the process of building a living willow dome gathered and tended from this site we've been at for about 7 years. And we'll talk more in our time together about some of the projects we're doing with partners and as part of our curriculum, but also as part of re-engaging and bringing community and our practices into these sites. So I think it's always important when we talk about decolonizing academia, we have to recognize how we got here. And so a lot of our programming is foundational in describing and understanding what the doctrine of discovery is. We're not going to go into all of that today, but over the years, my experience has been is that the excitement and thrill of re-engaging on the land and doing a project or restoration work or finding out what the gifts of our plant relatives are for food or for healing or for medicine making, folks can skip over the history of land and histories of genocide and manifest destiny and the doctrine of discovery, which have been key in not just removing Indigenous people from our traditional homelands, but also disrupting so many of our cultural practices in an effort to take land and make it into something else. And so when we look at the doctrine of discovery, as simple as recognizing in 1493 that when the Pope issued the announcement to everyone that if land was occupied by non-Christians, then they had no title to the land. And that began the story, and it continues today, of how Indigenous people globally have been marginalized and removed. As the papal bull explains, we have no more standing than a deer or a squirrel or a tree. And in some ways, part of what our iTech work is recognizing that to be standing with our trees and our salmon and our deer is a very powerful and connective relationship. And so how do we advocate on behalf of reclaiming this place we all call home for all of our relatives? And so the doctrine of discovery is something we're always trying to educate partners and governments about how we got here and what has to be done. We can follow through removal of ceded lands, tribal sovereignty, which we'll be sharing some of that information for tribal food sovereignty, but it's really across all land practice. Treaties and federal recognition, relocation, termination, restoration, and in the process now of reclamation, resurgence, and regeneration. Really dynamic time. But to understand all of those terms and to understand what has happened to people and place is critical to understanding reclamation, resurgence, and regeneration that's going on. So for Indigenous traditional ecological and cultural knowledge, impacts on protecting the health of all of our relatives. We were presenting at U of W quite a few years ago on these themes. And we recognize the role of Indigenous ways of knowing and the traditional land practices to inform and guide current land practices. It also represents new partnerships in education and land reclamation using an Indigenous cultural practice and holistic sustainability model. We'll look at sustainability as well. We recognize that it's the seventh generation, whether we're using the term sustainability, and there are many great Indigenous voices that are defining and redefining what is cultural sustainability, what does sustainability mean in our Indigenous leadership for sustainable futures. We take a look at that, we dismantle some of that, and then we reclaim it as understanding, living, thinking, planning for the future generations, the seventh generation. And so these serve as gathering places where our plant relatives can be cultivated and cultural traditions can be practiced. We recognize too, utilizing Indigenous traditional knowledge to restore land on behalf of our plant relatives to deepen our understanding of knowledge and engagement through our seasonal rounds, our seasonal tending, harvests, and educational workshops, which is part of in that first slide, what we're up to and what we're weaving into everything we do on campus and throughout the community. And it demonstrates a broader capacity building implications of Indigenous iTech on long-term land restoration and management. It serves as a basis for expanding this social cultural practice throughout the region and beyond. We're connecting internationally, and we'll share just a little bit about that too. Guiding values have come out of quite a few decades of being in our Indigenous community K through 12 before I arrived into higher ed, or whatever we're calling that, academia. I'm not sure it's higher, but it's academia. And part of what we do is we're always redefining and looking at the terminology that is out there and how do we break that up and recognize a non-hierarchical system. And so when we look at our guiding values, they're enduring, they have not changed. These have come over the many years, whether it was with our Native Montessori program, with Portland Public Schools, Title VII, Title IX, Title VI now, Indian education programs. But we can see remembering our responsibility to the seventh generation and remembering our responsibility to the land, recognizing the role of the sacred, all land is sacred. Reciprocity and interdependence, respecting cultural protocols, cultivating healthy relationships, we are all related, living, planning, designing, managing for the seventh generation. And these continue to guide the work. There are more, but these have taken up an enduring role in the development of iTech and what we're doing and working with our communities today. When we look at Indigenous land, local state and federal governments have a lot of that in their portfolios, and we recognize that in shifting that narrative to educate them, but to reclaim and to get back on the land and to start tending our plant relatives, but also to be with the water, bring our prayers back, scatter the seeds, get our children out there digging camas. We are creating the relationships and shifting again that narrative, creating new positions, new staffing that are centered in Indigenous guidance, Indigenous community outreach, but also Indigenous science and Indigenous visioning. So we're working with all of these, and certainly conservation and environmental organizations, and creating an awareness. And they're often the groups that really benefit from that other slide about how did we get here? What is manifest destiny? What is the doctrine of discovery? What happened? What does termination mean? It means just that, termination, which impacted tribes in the Northwest severely. And so we want to make sure they have an understanding, a profound capacity of understanding that the land that they're on has a story, and they will have to know that story to move forward, and they're not going to do it without Indigenous people. So those are some of the challenges over the last few decades that we continue to address and we continue to move forward with.
On that, talk a little bit about tribal food sovereignty, which is the world that I am lucky enough to get to work in. And I'm also working through a cold, so if I have to pause and cough, my apologies. So when I graduated from undergrad, I started a full-time job with my tribe in our culture department and had previously interned with them for many years while in undergrad, and did a lot of work with camas and huckleberry and smelt and wapato, and was working with all of these traditional foods, not realizing what all of that could mean or would look like in the future. And then I was asked by a colleague from our garden program to present with her on a food sovereignty panel. And I said, no, probably not. And she was like, what do you mean, Emma? And I'm like, I don't think that I would have enough to say about that. And she's like, you do food sovereignty work all of the time. But it was the first time I had ever heard that term. And so she explained it to me and I was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. There's a term for all of this work. And so food sovereignty is really diverse. It looks different for every person. It looks different for every community. But the National Congress of American Indians has this breakdown, which I think is helpful for folks that are just learning about food sovereignty. And that says, freely develop and implement self-determined definitions of food sovereignty. And that's like the biggest takeaway here, is that us as Indigenous communities, BIPOC communities, get to determine what our communities need, like for having that control back over their own food systems, for getting access to land, for knowing how their food is being tended, for having access to culturally appropriate foods, many things embedded in food sovereignty. And it really means like getting that control back to your local community and understanding how those foods are impacting your health. And so folks oftentimes will then ask, well, what's a tribal food sovereignty framework? And it's kind of the same answer. It looks different for everybody. But one of the important things here is that it does not only involve first foods. And so a lot of folks unfamiliar with Indigenous communities doing this kind of work will generally assume that it only involves our first foods, and our first foods are an extremely important part of it and very instrumental to this work. But it's also us having community wellness gardens and having like raised beds built in tribal members' backyards, things like that, because it's really just us having access and control over cultivating and caring for our own foods. And the general goals generally are to support community health and connection to your foodways. And a really big talk in the tribal food sovereignty world is this saying that's found within the Indigenous Food Sovereignty in the United States book, which I recommend if you're interested. And they say that you can't be sovereign if you can't feed your own people. And so a lot of us tribal nations in the U.S. That were lucky enough to be afforded tribal recognition, which also has many layers, are considered sovereign nations. But are we really sovereign if we can't feed our own people? And feeding your own people requires a lot. Like, can you manage your own buffalo herds? Can you have your own meat processing factory? Do you have enough tribal members interested in doing this work? Do you have enough community support from your tribal council? Do you have access to the lands? Are they safe? Are they contaminated? There's so many questions that we have to ask ourselves before we engage with different parts of the landscape because of safety conditions, but also just what it means to be an honorable harvester and engaging in the landscape in a respectful way to make sure that our plant relatives are receiving what they need from us as we take from them, which is generally not something folks think about. And so more Camas, because obviously Judy and I love Camas. And so what is a really big part of tribal food sovereignty is this world of seasonal rounds. And I think it is what it sounds like. Pre-contact Indigenous folks were able to follow their foods throughout the seasons. And so they were really well-versed in understanding the cues of the seasons. And so they would know that when this specific tree was changing, or this weather pattern, or these waters were rising, or the snow was melting off the mountains, like all of these cues were able to tell them, oh, it's about time to go to the Camas prairies. It's about time to go to the huckleberry meadows. Maybe the lamprey are coming in. It's going to be another run for the salmon. And so they really had to be aware of all of these plant relatives giving them cues so that they could know where to go next for their food sources. And they had it down to a science. And then obviously that was all interrupted and also illegalized and everything else. And so before that happened, though, because it was so seasonal, a lot of the times families and communities would go back to the same areas they were years and years and years before. They could store certain things to make traveling easier. And sometimes they'd be there for weeks at a time, sometimes months. It really depended upon what they were gathering and when the season was. And so one thing that Judy and I always like to connect folks with is this understanding of a cultural ecosystem, and it's a really big part of IPEC. And cultural ecosystems, I'm sure many of you have never heard of, and that's perfectly understandable and predictable, unfortunately. But cultural ecosystems are ecosystems that actually require human interaction to thrive and survive. And in our Western world, we're oftentimes taught that us humans only cause harm, and that if we want to conserve an area, you can like fix it, but then never touch it again because you're only going to cause more harm. And so these cultural ecosystems actually teach us differently. And they range from things like mountain huckleberry meadows, Camas prairies, the urban landscape that we're all probably in right now, and wetlands. And so what that means is that things like the Camas prairie, they need us to do cultural burns. They need us to remove competitive species like coniferous trees. They need us to come in and harvest because that harvesting actually aerates their soil and they really appreciate that aeration. And so those very intentional tending practices promote their health and they need that. And that was removed when we were no longer able to do those things. And we still in many forms cannot, but many tribes in the region now do have access to like slivers of things like Camas prairies, and they're very intentionally starting that reciprocal relationship with the land again, which is showing folks that, oh yeah, like that makes sense. I can see the difference of tending here versus not being able to engage with the land in that meaningful way. And so this obviously works against the Western standard of calling humans separate from the land because it shows us that we are not separate from the land. We are very much a part of it. And the reason why that threatens our Western system is because they really like to objectify Mother Earth and everything she provides us. And when folks start building these relationships and advocating and caring for the lands, it causes problems for industries that gain wealth from extracting, right? But we really need to do this work. We need folks to create these relationships and understand that their garden is a cultural ecosystem, and that they can create things like a microprairie in their backyard or the community garden and introduce native plants that maybe haven't been found in that landscape for generations. And that's how you reclaim the space.
Hi-yo, 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 sky, there I will be,
there I will be,
soaring with the eagle so high, feeling free. Remember me down the road, hand in hand, you and me. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh.
Hello, hey.
That was Remember Me by Fawn Wood, and before that you heard Judy Bluehorse Skelton and Emma Johnson talking about Indigenous traditional ecological and cultural knowledge. This is Robin White, and I'm your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour on listener-supported radio, KBOO Portland.
And this is Patricia Kohlberg again, interrupting our program for a moment to remind you that The Mole regularly features programming that you will not hear on commercial radio. If you like what you hear on our show, support us by donating to KBOO. Now is the perfect time to give, because your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $14,000 by a group of generous supporters. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by clicking on the donate button on your KBOO app. Here's Robin.
Next up, excerpts from a plenary panel on WSU's April 2023 SJCon conference exploring the intersections of Native sovereignty, decolonization, divestment, reparations, and environmental justice.
The panel is introduced by Nimiipuu Mole Julian Ankeny, Director of Native Programs, Washington State University, Vancouver.
As of 2023, over 1,500 institutions that control $40 trillion in assets have committed to divesting from fossil fuels, but still more action is needed to mobilize institutions of higher education, faith communities, unions, and local state and governments to divest from fossil fuels and other extractive industries and institutions that target Indigenous communities for exploitation and the fuel crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous people. The moral and political imperatives to reinvest in Indigenous communities hardest hit by extraction, exploitation, colonial violence, and a lot of this comes from law enforcement and man camps, sea level rise, extreme weather, and other manifestations of climate catastrophe, really do merit far more attention and action. How are our various institutions implicated in exploitation of Indigenous lands and people, and the exclusion of Indigenous people from equitable health outcomes, education, and investments, as well as access to traditional first foods? How do we document, make visible, and address these harms? How do we expand, build, and maintain coalitions to divest from fossil fuels and other extractive industries, institutions, and reinvest in those very Indigenous communities and try to repair the violence inherent in settler colonialism? what traditional and contemporary models of grassroots action, activism, organization, and coalition building can we draw from? As a land-grant institution, we recognize that the Morrell Act of 1862 established land-grant institutions by providing each state with public and federal lands, which are traced back to the dispossession of indigenous lands. In 1890, Washington State received 90,000 acres of indigenous lands designated to establish Washington State University. Washington State University still maintains and retains the majority of these lands to this day, something around 70,000 acres. We acknowledge that the dispossession of indigenous lands was taken by coercive and violent acts, as well as the disregard of treaties. For that, we extend our deepest apologies. We owe our deepest gratitude to Native peoples of this region and maintain our commitment towards reconciliation. Katsi Aoyao, thank you. So please give a welcome to Robin White. Thank you, Katsi Aoyao.
Climate collapse is upon us. We already know the causes. We also know that we have a lot less time than the original estimates gave us to heal this situation. And that's a very frightening thing for everyone. And we need to move this up on our list as we do other things and really realize how it affects every other part of our lives. We know that indigenous people are the most affected by this. The colonial and corporatocracy. Colonialism has been through corporations forever, whether it's the fur trade or the mining trade or trade in general has always been corporations backed up by governments, backed up by the church, and backed up by military and police. That hasn't changed any. That continues to be the same, particularly in the realm of fossil fuels. We can become allies in this, and we need to talk about that those alliances and particularly with Native peoples, how those alliances work, how they need to work. We have these entrenched vestiges of colonialism in all aspects of government and institutions, in particular the land-grant university system. Today we hope to examine the university's culpability in that fact and the fact that it still owns 80% of its original land from that land grant, and that they're making at least $4.5 million a year off of that just at WSU. The land was taken from tribes like the Chinook and the Duwamish that still fight for a seat at the council fires, at the table. You know, we need to look at how the institutions and systems continue to shut out Native voices and pit tribe against tribe in fights over scraps. We want to look at reparations and how they may be a direct answer to climate collapse and to the grip of the corporatocracy. You know, in order to stop climate collapse, in time to save us, we still need to get the money out of the fossil fuel industry. We need to reinvest that money in solutions that are good for labor and good for the community. We also need to talk about the snake oil salesman and the resurgence of the tumor of the nuke industry. We're going to be talking today a lot about the salmon scam and the Bolt decision and how incredibly important they've been, not only to Native peoples, but directly to the saving of the environment with treaty and sovereignty rights and the enforcement of those rights through the legal system and through the courts. Why don't we start with Mr. Robert Collin?
Indigenous people safeguard 80% of the global biodiversity. The medicines that are there, the species we haven't even looked at that may go, despite being less than 5% of the global population, because of the traditional knowledge of ancestors. Discussion here on this conference at 12:45 talks about decolonizing academia. In Africa, Chad, Burkina Faso, Benin, and Niger, all developed, indigenous people there, all developed at laws and national documents submitted to UN bodies. And guess who facilitated that? The largest indigenous person organized group in the world is in Africa. 135 indigenous peoples in 21 countries worked together and they helped each other. So there's real power and people joining other indigenous people, and we need that. The burden of climate change, but also the burden of mitigation is on those being hit the hardest, those that live the shortest lives, so that those that have the worst health. Internationally, indigenous people's rights have been violated all over the world. Land grabbing, that's a nice word for occasional murder. Forced displacement, destruction and contamination of land, destruction and contamination of water with uranium. That lasts probably, I would say 800 or 900 generations at least before it doesn't start killing you with weird cancers. So the destruction of ancient sites and places, the exclusion of this planet-saving group results in programs and ambitions and aspirations that are short-term focused, lack the buy-in to be real, and threaten long-term resilience of everyone.
Tim Ford?
I did some work still doing work with the Black Panther Party and came into the party in 1969 via the peace movement, not the civil rights movement. And then, of course, you know, things evolved over the years. I was hearing some talk about the islands and Pacific Islands, Polynesian Islands. But the party made alliances in all these islands, and including the Appalachian Mountains, working with the whites in Appalachia. That's because of Chairman Fred Hampton. You know, we're going to cross over racial solidarity, multiracial, multicultural, multiethical. We're going to cure racism with solidarity. And I've seen it a lot come together since post-George Floyd, actually. The struggle and the movement has accomplished more since post-George Floyd than civil rights accomplished in over 50 years. And why do I say that? Someone mentioned agriculture and the environment and all that. Well, there was a lady right here in Portland. She had a little agriculture thing where she distributed food in the neighborhood and everything. The state agriculture department showed up to her place, gave her a grant, and told her to apply for a USDA grant. Within 3 months, she had all this money that she hardly knew what to do with. And I met her on one of my walking tours. She came up and explained it to me. I began to put all that together, you know. I said, oh, this is because of post-George Floyd. Ever since they've been tracking these police murders during the Obama administration in 2015, every year you can go to the Washington Post, and the great lady in New York, the New York Times, and you can go to any of these guys. 1,000, 1,100, 1,200 people being dusted by the police every year. In a monument, in a whole European Union, just last year, only 10 people got dusted by the police. And we had a 10-point platform and program, land, bread, housing, that related to the struggle of indigenous people in the world. Number 7, we want to be the end of police brutality and murder of Black people. That's more valid today than was written back in by a group of Mary College students back in 1966. We fed over 30,000 kids a week nationwide. And seen over 100 patients a week at the health clinics and dental clinics. Come to us. Tell us what's going on. We'll be right there with you to try to fix the problem, whatever it was.
Kathy Sampson-Cruz.
Hi, Katsiaya. Sheikh Haskumpa, good morning. I want to have a big thank you, a big warm hug to everyone who is speaking and to all those who are listening. You are the ones who can create change. You are the ones who can turn your voice into action. Your great-grandchildren will remember the pain and destruction that has been brought on by the bazillionaire class, the corporate bullies, the alternative universe of lies and deceit that has been told over 500 years. Those lies and deceit have consequences. We, the people, take that historical trauma and that endured pain, and we rose to action. We demand accountability and justice and unity that can move the compass of moral obligation to do something. You are the ones whose great-grandchildren will tell stories to their children about the struggle, the movement, and the revolution of change that happened. We have the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians that many of you have elected members, or you can join as individuals or allies. And I have met a wonderful group of people in the Northwest that are willing to lay their bodies on the line to make their voices and their actions happen. One of those people that I met is an amazing woman. It's probably been 10 years now. She's with the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, and her name is Lauren Reagan. If you don't know about cldc.org, look it up. Donate what you can, because her organization has represented thousands of people who have resisted and have stood up for the moral compass against what we are now looking at, green colonialism. How do we take those people's ancestors, elders, beloved ones, words, and keep them so close to our heart and be able to stand up, rise up, and make peace with nature in this current economic, global foreshadowing of a disaster that is coming for our grandchildren? It brings me back to my young days, you know, whether it was marching against Vietnam or at Portland State on, you know, apartheid, or back at NYC not that long ago, staying with Code Pink people in Harlem. When you see those big groups of people that want change, and then on the same hand, we have leaders in the environmental movement that are truly selling us out. And yes, I'm going to name them: Jim Hansen, Bill McKibben. You know, then we have gazillionaires like Bezos and Gates trying to invest in small modular nuclear reactors and deploy them across the continent. You know, there's this shake my head time that we have to regroup before that kind of green sellout continues to happen. The land, the air, and the water. We cannot forget that, Tumin, in our heart, we have to do better.
Kuhayam, Rachel Kushmaneke, Yachul, Naika Tulakum, Insaika, Chinookin Nation, Insaika Klatsa, Kahlamet, Wakayakum, Wulupa, Pilor Chinook. Hello, my name is Rachel Cushman. I am, as Robin has said, a hereditary and elected leader of the Chinook Indian Nation. We are the five most Western Chinookin speaking tribes at the mouth of the Columbia River. We are in both Oregon and Washington. On the Oregon side, we are Clatsop and Kathlamet. On the Washington side, we are Kaikum, Willapa, and Lower Chinook. And I've been working to protect Indigenous rights, land, and sovereignty for over 20 years. I was raised to do this work. That's what my family brought me into this world to do, and have had me training with elders, traditional ecological knowledge keepers, allies since I was a child. I am a scholar. I've written quite a bit about resurgence of Indigenous lifeways on the landscape. I have written about pigmentocracy. I've written about different ways of teaching. I've helped develop curriculum. I am a PhD student at the University of Oregon, working on a degree in Indigenous race and ethnic studies. The focus of my work is on recognition politics, particularly, and that's because of the community that I come from and the work that we're doing. I'm also a 2022 Indian Collective Changemaker Fellow, where I am working with other Indigenous leaders throughout the Western Hemisphere to defend, develop, and decolonize the landscape. I actually just wrote a paper and submitted it to a publisher a couple weeks ago. It's called We Demand Respect, Practicing Radical Sovereignty and Unsettling Environmentalism. For those that don't know, the Chinook Indian Nation is a community facing slow motion genocide. We've been fighting since 1851 for our rights. We've signed treaties at the negotiation table with the United States government that those treaties went back east and were tabled indefinitely. And we filed our first lawsuit against the federal government in 1899. We won that lawsuit. We won multiple other acts of the Supreme Court as well as Congress over the decades, but we live in a legal limbo area. We've been actively fighting for our rights my whole life. So this is what I was born into, a fight for justice. And I could talk more about that, but it would take the whole time to talk about Chinook justice. There is a website, chinookjustice.org, if you're interested in learning more specifically about our fight for federal acknowledgement. Sovereignty is not based on federal acknowledgement. Sovereignty comes from the land. It comes from the ancestors, from the people. It cannot be bestowed upon a nation. We are a sovereign nation regardless of our acknowledgement, and we practice that sovereignty.
That was Electric Powwow Drum by A Tribe Called Red. And before that, you were listening to excerpts from WSU's April 2023 SJCon conference. This is Robin White, and I'm your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour on listener-supported KBOO Portland Radio.
This is Patricia Kohlberg again. KBOO is now in its fall membership drive and hoping to raise $55,000. Donate right now, and your gift will be matched dollar for dollar up to $14,000. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by clicking on the donate button on your KBOO app. And thanks to everyone who has given so generously in the past. Now, back to our program.
Next up on today's show is a reading from C. Marie Furman.
This is a story about a South Fork Salmon River logging road and what it means to be a good ancestor. And this is the story of a river, a road, and a fish. The river is the South Fork of the Salmon. More specifically, it is the stretch of the South Fork of the Salmon River that begins in a meadow named Stoley until it joins the Seasash River beneath my favorite bridge. Bridge that curves in a way to suggest it is hugging the river, that curves like a comma, asking drivers to pause as they cross, to pause and look into the water below. Look in, as if there are answers there to our important questions. Look in, because there are answers there. This bridge is not on the road that the story is interested in, but the road and the bridge and the fish that swim in the river are all on the way to the trail where the story begins. The trail, like the river, like the fish, predate white settlement. Yet it was worn by human feet. It is kept up now by hooves and paws, and on a day in late May of 2022, it knows the tread of my own soles, following the tread of my partner, the paws of my two dogs, and the notion of wonder. On this day, the hill we climb is golden with arrowleaf balsam root. I have known many flowers, but the balsam root, to my knowing, is most companionable. Iris of gold, pupil of earth, I am never alone when I'm walking among them, each greeting me from beside the trail, each eye watching my step, giving me glimpses in the soil that is the soul of all beings. Looking now into those brown eyes, I see ancestors, human and greater than, every being whose bone and ash fed the balsam root's bloom, fed the others that grow here too, fed the deer whose body fed my own. Once, before I stopped picking flowers, I tucked a stem behind my ear and for a moment gained another sight. In that moment, seeing through the soil color and gilded eye, I saw what I think I can call immutability. For a moment, I knew what was meant by the words, "Look to the lilies, how they grow. They toil not, nor do they spin." And for a moment, I toiled not, nor spun as well. But this morning, the one of our story, the one after I stopped picking flowers, choosing instead to hold them with my own eyes, sometimes a lens, let them grow and flourish to be breakfast for deer or vole, or just remain in poetry as the place where sunrises are born. This morning, I greeted them as I toiled up the steep trail, the very old trail, with my dogs, my man, and the song of robins above me, and the river and salmon below. To know the landscape of the South Fork of the Salmon River, hold your hands at heart level, palms down, spread the fingers of one hand and then the other and weave them together, stopping at your first knuckle. Here is where the river winds through, still cutting the canyon that holds it. And there, between your fingers, are the drainages. We can name a few now, but know that names are mutable and they have had many and may have many to come. But today, let's call them Buckhorn and Camp and Phoebe and Nasty. And if you can imagine the landscape of your hands as big as mountains, like the Salmon River mountains that hold the South Fork of the Salmon River, you will see how steep your fingers have become. What a travail it may be to get to the back of your hand. Ah, but what a gift the summit will be when you get there. The view notwithstanding, the back of your hand becomes a place to hope for, an easier walk, a rest. This is where we are headed, the back of your hand that is the summit and the ridge. Though, for the sake of our story and the stories yet to come, let's not name the drainage we walk, nor the creek that runs through it. Forgive my lie of omission, but trails like the one we are taking to the back of your hand are best left unnamed, just as some wishes are left unspoken if you want them to come true. This morning, the air is cool. It will rain. This, my partner, the fish biologist, tells me is salmon weather. And yes, there are salmon in the South Fork of the Salmon River, or soon they will be. And they are part of the story of river and road. But for the sake of the story, let's say they are more than salmon. Let's say they're a symbol for all life in the river, from steelhead to sculpin, mussel to lamprey. And the weather matters greatly to this story, particularly that it is salmon weather, because salmon weather means rain, and rain means that from the top and sides of the hills that we see in your hands, water will flow down, down, down into the streams and the sea sesh, and down into the South Fork of the Salmon River that flows down to the main Salmon River itself and is passing now, not too far from here, in a river called the Clearwater, which joins the Columbia and then the Pacific. And somewhere in that salinate water, right now, spring Chinook are turning their bodies east, turning their bodies back to fresh water, and carrying within those bodies food for the balsam root and black bear and even the ponderosa, carrying life in its myriad forms, in eggs or milt, carrying life back to the South Fork of the Salmon River. The salmon are carrying this life and their own story as they make their way upstream, a travail not like the short and simple walk up the drainage of our hands, but one that must overcome dams, resist currents, jump falls, to come to the headwaters where our story and the river began. Spring rain, spring snow, runoff, water. The banks of the creeks fill, even only if slightly. They rise in the sea sesh and the South Fork of the Salmon and the Main and so on down the line and in times before the dams, before man opened gates, was gatekeeper to passage. The rising water made it easier for the salmon to maneuver around boulders, over falls, and make their way up thin streams and wrist-like tributaries to that place where even now lie the eggs that will soon hatch and the bodies that will grow and grow. And eventually, this salmon weather will be the spring water they ride down, passing us, passing their ancestors, passing the story on to a new generation. There is something else about the rain. When it falls, as soon it will, on the ridge and the drainage and the trail which we walked on that early May morning, it will loosen the soil. Snow knows this too. And that soil and rain will let go some small bits of earth which will roll down the hillside, past the arrow leaf and lodgepole, to an old dirt road. And this is where our story may have stopped, because in this landscape and this story, the road begins to complicate things, like dams. It begins to disrupt a natural order, the downward movement. It disrupts relationship between slope and rain and river and fish. It is as if mid-stride, mid-step, me and the dogs and the fish biologist named Caleb freeze. As a photograph stills a moment, but it is more complicated than that, and yet it is also like pausing life, because those hillsides, like the salmon turning east in the Pacific, like me giving you this story, are meant to give something to the river.
Calling all dancers, let's put on our dancing shoes. We're gonna do the barbecue. It's good for you. Live it up.
That was DJ Shrub doing a Calling All Dancers. And before that, you heard a reading from C. Marie Furman. This is Lakota Cheyenne Mole Robin White, and you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your listener-supported radio station. Along with the reading from C. Marie Furman's Today's Show featured commentary from Professor Judy Bluehorse Skelton and Emma Johnson, along with a plenary panel from WSU's April 2023 conference exploring the intersections of Native sovereignty, decolonization, divestment, reparations, and environmental justice. Today's Indigenous Peoples Day show was co-produced and co-edited by Patricia Kohlberg and Desiree Helligers.
And this is Patricia Kohlberg with one final announcement. Did you know that if you donate to KBOO now, you can double your donation? That's right. A generous group of KBOO donors has offered to match your donation dollar for dollar up to $14,000. It's a great reason to give now to keep community radio alive in Portland. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by clicking on the donate button on your KBOO app.
We're going to play out with the Ulali singing Mother.
Way down, 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 way down
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if the meeting